Hello, everybody. It's Sam from Financial Samurai, and I hope everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. In this episode, I want to talk about patient capital because the market is getting rocked, the stock market, that is, and certain stocks, especially in the big cap tech sector, are just getting crushed. They're down 20 to 40% in a matter of a couple months, and that is pretty scary, folks, if you were buying at the top and, you know, a bear market is down 20%. Technically, a correction is only down 10%. So the S&P 500 is down about 10% from its highs. And people are wondering, what's next? You know, what's next is, hey, there's only two variables that can give us hope for the rest of the year. One is when President Trump and President Xi from China meet in Buenos Aires. And hopefully they're going to talk about some negotiations and trade pacts that they can work themselves way into an agreement for 2019. I think that's going to give a lot of confidence to the market. You know, Trump did that with North Korea. I mean, who would have thought that Trump, North Korea, South Korea, these guys could all meet and develop a relationship. So I have hopes there that Trump is not going to be driving the U.S. economy into the ground and shaking confidence by just being stubborn and saying, no, you know, kowtow to my demands or else. And the second piece of hope is Powell, Fed Chair Powell, speaking to us this week, hopefully, and saying, hey, you know what, for 2019, we're going to see what's going to go on with inflation, employment, earnings growth, the real estate market, and we will be flexible in terms of how much we're going to hike. The market, well, investors are expecting another 3 to 4 rate hikes in 2019, and that sounds ridiculous to me now that you know the market has sold off 10%. And it's clear to me the real estate market, on the coast at least, are slowing down. They're slowing down everywhere. And it's clear to me that corporate guidance for 2019 is also not so robust. Therefore, the 2% inflation target that the Fed has, it's right there. It's not accelerating in terms of inflation. Anyway, so patient capital. I was looking through, you know, just reflecting a lot this Thanksgiving weekend, and I realized that all my biggest investment wins have occurred because I waited 10 years or longer before selling. There was only one stock that I made a really large sum of money in 6 months, but that was due to the dot-com bubble. And it was all just luck. That was VCSY back in, I think it was 2000. So on the other hand, there are plenty of stocks I lost tons of money on because I got shaken out way too early. And if I had held on to them, I would have been much better off. So I define patient capital as investments that often take at least 5 years to see a return. Patient capital consists of investments in real estate, private equity, and your own business. For stocks, not so much patient capital because it's too easy to get in and out with a click of a button. The friction is too small, which causes a lot of people just to get scared and sell at the bottom and buy at the top. Patient capital is why the world's wealthiest people and the largest institutional funds have a minority of their net worth in public investments. They know that by removing the temptation to get in and out of investments during times of volatility, they stand a better chance to make higher returns. Think about all the people, right, that freaked out in 2008 and 2010. I know personally friends who sold their properties, you know, there were short sales in 2009 and 2010, and now these properties are worth 40% more than when they, you know, sold them. Actually, no, much more. And then I know some people who sold stocks at the bottom of the financial crisis as well, and they're all kicking themselves. Further, patient capital realizes there are potential arbitrage opportunities to exploit in illiquid investments. You know, when you don't have the entire world competing against you, you know, you don't have these algorithms just, you know, when markets are selling off, they press and they sell off more. There's just so much volatility. It's just much easier to find opportunities when you have private investments. So let's take a look at the latest asset allocation of the $30 billion Yale Endowment Fund, which has returned 11.8% a year for the past 20 years. And if you click over to the post, you'll check out this chart, but I'll just read it to you. Absolute return, 26% allocation. Venture capital, 18%. Foreign equity, 15.5%. That's been a bust recently. Leveraged buyouts, 15%. real estate 9.5%, bonds and cash 6.5%, natural resources 6.5%, and then domestic equity only 3%. So what stands out most from Yale's asset allocation, again, they have $30 billion, is how little there is in traditional domestic equity, 3%, and bonds and cash, 6.5%. So 90%+ of their assets are in patient capital investments. Their 26% asset allocation into absolute return are investments in hedge funds that likely have a blend of long-short equity and credit investments. However, these funds have long-term lockups as well. We're talking 5 to 10-year lockups here. And then in the post, you'll see an asset allocation breakdown by net worth, which was mentioned in a previous post that shows how patient capital grows with wealth. So if you look at people with $10,000 in net worth, primary residence and their vehicle stand to be the largest portion of their net worth. And then if you look at someone with $1 million in net worth, primary residence shrinks, vehicles, thank goodness, shrinks. But what increases is business interests. And then at 10 million, 100 million, a billion, it's all about business interests. So for those who want to build a business, that's where most of the wealthy people have their net worth stashed. So illiquidity premium. In a key study 25 years ago, Michael Jensen of Harvard University argued that the tradable nature of any public corporation generates an inherent discount because of the fundamental conflict between those who bear the risks, you and me, the shareholders, minority shareholders, and those who manage the risk, in other words, the executives, over the payout of the free cash flow. So Jensen noted that public corporations tend to hold twice the amount of cash as private companies, which by contrast exhibit higher equity ownership by managers and more leveraged corporate structures that help limit the non-utilization of free cash flow. So less cash drag. Private companies were thus seen as better aligning the interests of owners and managers, and in fact, appeared to Mr. Jensen to achieve remarkable gains in operating efficiency, employee productivity, and shareholder value. So it's kind of a convoluted way of saying, if you're a shareholder, let's say you're at a startup, you care more and you're just optimizing your free cash flow and you're trying to do your best to grow your business. Whereas, if you are part of this big lumbering public company, you can't make that much of a difference and you're really not a significant shareholder, so you don't really care as much. So obviously, the poorer you are, the less you can afford to tie up your capital in patient investments. But if you want to get wealthy, your goal is to think and act like the wealthy, right? That's just a no-brainer. And that's why I'm sharing this podcast with you and this post to you. When I need a dose of inspiration to, get up early or work harder or whatever, I go running amidst the mansions in San Francisco. I don't go to the mall and start splurging on stupid things I don't need, right? And when you have a lot of liquidity, financial discipline tends to get thrown out the window. The cash burns a hole in your pocket waiting to get spent. This phenomenon is why paying yourself first is a fundamental principle behind good personal finance habits. The government pays itself first by forcing companies to deduct taxes from each paycheck because it knows there will be a huge revenue shortfall if it does not. Without liquidity, your temptation to spend on things you don't need goes away. The longer you can lock up your patient capital, the more time you give your investments to compound. Being able to more easily sit tight is why real estate is one of my favorite asset classes to build long-term wealth. So what is illiquidity worth? Well, it's really hard to measure, but one study focusing on hedge funds, which haven't been great performers, showed that funds with longer lockups enable managers to invest in less liquid holdings tend to earn higher returns than those without. The data there indicated that fund returns actually rise as their lockup periods increases from a median of 4.5% for funds with lockups of less than a fiscal quarter up to a median return of almost 13% for funds with a 2 to 3 year lockup. So that's a pretty significant difference. And think about it, as an investor, I just want to put money away, lock it up, and have a nice IRR for the next 5-10 years. I don't want to just sell it and figure out what to do next with it. I just want something that just keeps on going. And, you know, hedge funds aren't the greatest example right now because they've lagged the S&P 500 because it's been a bull market since 2008, 2009. But the point is that lockups provide superior returns in this one study. In this other study by researchers from the University of Chicago, Virginia, and Oxford showed that while venture capital results varied, U.S. buyout funds generally outperformed publicly traded equities by as much as 3% annually. So to capture some of the illiquidity premium, institutions and endowments typically hold a significant portion of their portfolio in alternative investments, as we saw with the Yale endowment example. So the question you got to ask yourself is, what do they know that we don't? Well, investors seem to understand that individual investors are missing out on the illiquidity premium by just buying stocks. So the best asset class for most people to take advantage of an illiquidity premium is real estate. I mean, real estate is really the easiest way to invest, not worry about the ups and downs, and hold for the long term. It takes a big commitment, right, to get in if you are buying property individually, and there are fees and taxes to pay if you want to get out. But over time, as you pay down debt and watch rents and principal grow, your equity starts to expand. Paying down debt becomes almost an unconscious habit because your mortgage is on auto deduct. Meanwhile, rents tend to go up over time simply due to inflation. And also during recessions, rents are sticky on the way down because generally it's like, you know, moving costs are a pain, and, you know, rent leases are like 1 year, and recessions only last about 6 months to 18 months long. If you can also capture principal appreciation when you own real estate, then I dare say you will likely return a handsome profit if you can hold on for 10 plus years. And of course, if you don't want to own and manage your own property, then real estate crowdfunding finance marketplaces can help smooth the way for investors to participate in private investments that can potentially help them realize the real estate illiquidity premium. As for me, my long-term wealth creation plan is to continue investing in real estate and building an online business. It's all about patient capital here for me, folks. Real estate, you know, and I know that in 10, 20, 30 years, real estate is probably going to be much higher than it is now. And also just the online business, I'm in my 10th year now, and my goal is to run it for as long as possible unless there's an amazing offer. But I'm telling you, folks, I've seen the progression of Financial Samurai from 2009 to 2018 and almost 2019 now, and it just keeps on compounding. And it's unbelievable, once you build a brand and you build some momentum, how much more you can leverage your platform. So I really recommend either you guys start your own site or figure out some kind of business where you can just enjoy and keep on building it over time, because these gains really, really start building upon each other. Now, stocks, on the other hand, you know, continue to create the greatest challenge for me in terms of patient capital. I've just got to be really honest here. I'm not someone who can sit tight as easily as if I just own real estate. You know, the slow rise, it's like walking up steps, and then quick decimation of stocks, like riding an elevator down, forces me to limit my overall stock exposure to no more than 25% of my net worth. I mean, it's really like 25%. I remember when I was younger, 20s, 30s, yeah, 50% plus. But now, I don't want to entrust my wealth to the whims of the stock market, exogenous variables and endogenous variables. So I'd love to hear from you folks what you think is the best patient capital investments, and what do you see for 2019 and beyond? Do you find that the stock market is fairly valued here after it corrected by 10%? And are you able to hold on to stocks as easily as you can with real estate and other type of assets going forward? Thanks so much, everyone.